This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tim O'Brien, is best known for his novels and stories about the Vietnam War. He did a tour of duty in Vietnam as a foot soldier in 1969, after he was drafted. He won a 1979 National Book Award for his novel Going After Cacciato. His 1990 novel, The Things They Carried, was included in a Library of Congress exhibit of the books that had a profound effect on American life. O'Brien is the subject of the new documentary, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien. It focuses on his life after becoming a father in 2003, in his late 50s. He had no interest in becoming a father, but was talked into it by Meredith, the woman who later became his wife, who gave him an ultimatum. She didn't see a future for herself in that relationship, unless they committed to having children. But once his children were born, he was all in. He even gave up writing for many years to raise them with his wife. His latest book, Dad's Maybe Book, his first since his children were born, was published in 2019 when his sons were in their teens. The new documentary, among other things, reflects on his memories of the war, how it's continued to affect his life, and how that in turn has affected his wife and sons. It's also about facing mortality as a soldier and now as an older man. Tim O'Brien, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's been a long time. It is a pleasure to have you back on our show. You didn't become a father until you were older, in your late 50s. You'd resisted it. And you nearly broke up with Meredith, the woman who became your wife, because there was no future in the relationship for her without children. So having children turned out to be a really profound experience for you. Why do you think you were so resistant to being a father until you became one?
Well, partly personal greed, I think, a kind of desire to have my life entirely as my own. There was a element of fear involved, too. In fact, maybe that was paramount. I had had a tough childhood. My dad was an alcoholic. And sometimes he wasn't physically present, but he also was not emotionally present much of the time. He was a great man in many ways. He was funny. He was fun to be around when he was sober. But when he was not, life was hard as a 9-year-old and a 14-year-old and in those years in between. And I feared that I may have inherited whatever chromosome caused that. And I did not want to be a bad father.
What changed your mind about fatherhood after becoming a father? What made you feel so positive about it? I mean, obviously your sons made you feel that way, but I mean, it sounds like it was not what you were expecting it to be. So what were the really good parts of it that surprised you, that you hadn't expected?
I hadn't expected otherness, that sense of another human being who was not Tim O'Brien, whom I could love wholeheartedly and feel as if I were under the skin and inside the bodies and the blood of these two little boys, now teenagers. I feel the same. There's a sense of otherness where I count a lot less than I used to, because my head is occupied by two other human beings and my wife. That is a beautiful relief from what had been 58 years of Tim O'Brien-ness.
You're 74 now and your children are in their teens. So you worry that they'll never really know you as adults, that you might not live long enough for them to reach like full adulthood. And there's a scene in the documentary where one of your children is basically crying and expressing his fear that you're going to die because you're old. How do you talk to your children about being relatively old, like much older than their friends' parents?
I talk to them pretty bluntly. When they say, "Dad, you're old, you're going to die," I say, "I know, sad." I don't say no, and I don't deny it, because it's a lie, and I don't want to leave them with a lie. The reality is the reality, and they've adjusted to it over time. the crying has stopped. Especially my older boy, Timmy, would really weep about it. He'd come out in the middle of the night and wake me up and say, "What you just said, you're going to die, Dad. And I can't stand it." And we would talk about my age and what a great gift it had been to spend time with him already. Now, when my older boy is 17 and my younger Tad is 15, they still think about it. I still think about it. My wife still thinks about it. But it's not in a macabre kind of way. It's not grim. It's growing comfortable with reality. And we have a happy house. I think partly because we don't deny reality.
Your father was a regional manager for a life insurance company, and in that sense, I would imagine part of his job was guesstimating when customers would die, you know, because that's what you have to do in life insurance. Like, how long are they likely to live? What are they likely to die of? And then you could base, you know, the cost of the premium on that. So did you grow up with those kind of actuarial tables and with your knowing that your father was, you know, busy calculating how long people would live?
My dad used to joke about it. He'd say, I'd say, "What's your job?" And he'd say, "My job is selling bad news." Like, essentially what he was doing. He hated his job. He came from Brooklyn, where he grew up as a kid, lived in Nassau for a short time, went to the South Pacific in World War II. And he ended up in a little cow town in the middle of nowhere in southern Minnesota, more strictly a turkey town, surrounded by soybeans and cornfields. He hated it. He missed Brooklyn. He missed New York in general. He missed the excitement of life as he had once known it, in the war, in Nassau, and in Brooklyn. And so he was doing what for him, I think, was a dead-end job. He had dreamed of being a writer. Back during the war, he had written letters for his shipmates in the Navy and letters home. He'd compose them and the whole damn thing. And then the guy whose letter he was writing would sign it and send it to his wife or girlfriend. My dad was a really fine writer in a kind of Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, chipper kind of way, like those old movies. That his writing was very upbeat, often funny, almost the reverse of his son's. And I think he would have been a fine writer of a certain kind. But he had to raise three kids and, you know, put food on the table.
You know, what you just said about your father, that he really wanted to be a writer, but he was stuck in this, like, small farming town away from Brooklyn, away from the things he loved. He couldn't have a writing career. Do you think that has to do with not wanting to be a father yourself, because you associated, like, children and family with coming along with a certain deprivation that you can't fulfill your dreams if you have a family to support, and it's going to take you away? You'll be with people you love, but it's going to take you away from your own ambitions.
It was a mixture of really two things: fear that I'd be a bad father, and that greed or selfishness thing I'd mentioned, that I'd always identified myself as a writer from the time I was a little boy. That's what I wanted to be and do, and that's what I valued, making graceful sentences. I just loved it. I hated the pain of it, but I loved the doing of it. And I thought that with a child in the house and then two children in the house, that would end. It did end, and much to my surprise, it was a great relief when it did. I was able to move away from myself and into these two other lives.
So I have to ask you, since you've had pneumonia several times, are you still smoking?
I am right now, yeah. We all have our faults, and I'm afraid that's mine. I don't smoke around the kids. and they don't smell my smoke. And I do it in one room in the house where I am right now. But I do smoke. They know I do. I go outside a lot and do it out there, and also in this room full of smoke-eating machines. But they're not allowed in. I fear I won't ever write again if I don't, and that weighs on me because I do want to write again.
So I don't mean to sound like a scold or, you know, to pass judgment or anything, but, you know, like when you were in Vietnam, you were living on the edge of death because you could have been killed any second. You were in combat. Now it's almost like because your lungs are not in great shape and you've had, you know, pneumonia four times in one of those cases, you were in a coma. It's like now you're unintentionally like killing yourself. And I find it upsetting. So I can only imagine how your family feels.
Well, I understand exactly what you're saying. It's an irrational thing in a way, but there's a element of rationality in it, though it's not wholly irrational, in that we're all going to die of something. I'm 74 years old. I want to write, and I want to use what time I do have to write another book, or at least try to. And I know I could not do that without it. Or I think I know it anyway.
And maybe you're wrong.
And maybe I am, but maybe I'm right. I don't want to go through the possibility that I might be right for the possibility I might be wrong. I'd rather be sure I'm going to.
So again, I don't say this to be judgmental, but just to kind of understand, like, you know, in the movie you say, like, you would do anything to have more years with your sons. But I guess the thing that you won't do is stop smoking.
Well, I didn't quite say anything. I said
you said you'd give every book. Yeah, every book that you wrote.
Right. That I would do. But I wouldn't give writing again. It'd be like giving up myself in a way. It'd be a kind of death if I were not to write again. And I think other people who do things that are really important to them do similar kinds of things to keep, I don't know, keep doing what it is they felt they were put here to do. It's intimidating to find rational answers to things at the spur of the moment. I knew you'd been asked something I would not be able to handle, and that you just did it. All I can say is it's irrational. I know it's irrational, and I'll take your advice. I'll stop. Like right now, I'll put it out as soon as it's finished.
That sounds like a great solution. How do you think the other soldiers that you were with thought of you? Your nickname was College Joe, because, I mean, you were a reader, you were a writer. You went to Harvard after the war. I don't know if College Joe was just a nickname or whether it was meant to be complimentary or derogatory or neutral. But, you know, a lot of the skills that you had, I don't know how physical a person you were. But a lot of the intellectual skills that you had might not have come in very handy when it came to, like, trying to protect yourself and other soldiers.
No, they did. You're absolutely right. They did not come in handy. I hated Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts. I didn't like bugs and sleeping in the rain and none of that. And I didn't know anything about weapons. And a lot of the guys I served with were outdoor types, and they did like and know that stuff. So I think the College Joe thing was maybe not derogatory, but it was an acknowledgement that I wasn't cut out to be a soldier, and I wasn't. I did the one thing I could do, which was I just kept humping, just kept my legs moving. I didn't fall to the ground. I didn't quit. You know, I didn't say, take me, you know, to some insane asylum and lock me away. I did keep going. And I look back on that as the only kind of source of pride out of it all. Somehow I endured it all. That's something. And the problem for me really is that I questioned the rectitude of the war, period. I thought I was doing the wrong thing by being there. And it ate at me constantly. Where most of the men around me thought we should, you know, invade North Vietnam and put a big iron curtain around Hanoi and then bomb the hell out of it. That is the was one of the big psychological burdens, and it's been a source of continuing guilt and shame that I actually went to that thing and participated in it. If there's a single burden that I have to carry through my life that's the heaviest, it's that sense of I shouldn't have done it.
Well, you'd considered deserting, right? You'd consider, first you considered just like going to Canada. You were living in Minnesota, so you could have crossed the border, I think it was like 90 miles away or something. So you could have done that, and you considered doing that. But you thought that that would be interpreted as an act of cowardice. And I'm wondering why you thought of it as an act of cowardice as opposed to an act of courage, because you would have been taking a stand that you believed was the morally correct position to have.
Yes, it would have been an act of courage for me, but not viewed that way by people in a small, conservative, small-town Minnesota.
It Does that include your parents?
No. One of my parents was for the war, the other was against it, but neither would have viewed it that way. The rest of the townsfolk, I'm very, very sure, would not have viewed it that way. They'd have looked at me as treasonous and a traitor to his country and a coward, even though I would have viewed it as an act of courage that I couldn't do. I wasn't brave enough to cross the border into Canada. Instead, I let myself go to that war, not to please myself, but to please my hometown.
You say in the film that there have been times when you've done a reading or given a talk, and somebody comes up to you afterwards and says, "Thank you for that. Now I know for sure I want to enlist." And you're just kind of mystified, like, how is that the message that they took away from someone who is as anti-war as you are? I mean, how is that the message? Do you have any idea, like, why somebody would be convinced to join a war after hearing you?
Even if you listen to the most grisly, disgusting and horrendous war story imaginable, the imagination of some people bring to that, I can do better. I can imagine myself behaving with decorous, valorous behavior in the face of all that. Hemingway once said, among other smart things that guy said, that the problem with courage in a war is, and the problem with cowardice in a war is either too much or too little imagination. Those with not enough imagination can be really brave in a war, can charge the enemy machine guns because they can't imagine themselves dying. Or they don't imagine themselves dying. They imagine themselves overwhelming the machine gun somehow. And those other people who don't charge the machine gun imagine themselves being shot in the face. That was my kind of imagination.
You know, the title of your novel, The Things They Carried, is an allusion to the things that soldiers have to carry on them and in their backpack when they're in war. And then also the things that you carry to keep your sanity, like the letters that you keep or the book that you carry with you or whatever it is. During the period when you were a young father, and the things that you carried were probably like a diaper bag, you know, with all the stuff for your baby's needs. Did you think about the comparison?
Yeah, I think about it all the time, even when it's not related to kids. Yeah. The title, The Things They Carried, was really meant, the word they is meant to encompass not just soldiers, but the mothers of soldiers, the fathers. But to go even beyond that, the things you carry as a broadcaster and an interviewer, the worries you carry. Did I do a good enough job? Did I ask the right questions? Did I elicit what I was after? You know how you take those things home with you. There are successful interviews, and then there are ones such as this one that are less successful. And you carry it home with you, and you worry about it. It goes to doctors and stockbrokers that we all carry physical stuff that represent who we are, but we also carry the emotional aftershocks of our lives, the joys and the sadness and everything else.
In what sense is this a less successful interview?
My own performance, the smoking question really flipped me, mainly because I knew you were right. But I don't know. I never feel that you're such a good interviewer that I always feel inadequate in your presence. And that's never, I'll be 90 and you'll be interviewing me and it'll be the same damn thing.
That's ridiculous. I have one more question for you. Have you ever visited the Vietnam War Memorial, the one with all the names of the people killed in Vietnam, designed by Maya Lin? What was that experience like for you?
It was a tearful experience. I broke down and wept. I found the names of people that had died in my presence and put my fingers on their names and leaned against that wall. Makes me cry now, just remembering that moment. It was near dusk, almost dark, and the shadows over the wall were like the shadows of the war over me and my friends. It was an emotional time, and it's a beautiful, elegiac monument to human suffering.
Tim O'Brien, it's been great to talk with you again. I really appreciate you doing this interview. Thank you so much.
You're the best of the best, Terry. There's nobody as good as you, and I don't think there ever will be.
Thank you. That means so much to me. Thank you for the interview and for your books, and I look forward to the next one. Tim O'Brien is the subject of the new documentary, The War and Peace of Tim O'Brien. It's now available on video and cable on demand. One of the newest miniseries on Netflix is a 6-part drama called Behind Her Eyes, which our TV critic David Bianculli says is absolutely astounding, but difficult to talk about. He's not going to divulge or even detail its central mysteries and surprises because he says they're both pivotal and excitingly original. Here is his spoiler-free but very enthusiastic review.
Behind Her Eyes is based on the 2017 novel by Sarah Pinborough. And if you've read that book, you already know what to expect. But if you have no idea, you ought to do everything you can to keep it that way and come to this new 6-part Netflix miniseries as uninformed as possible. Just promise yourself in advance that you'll stay with it and allow its secrets to slowly reveal themselves. Get to the end, the very end, and I all but guarantee you'll be ready to start watching the whole thing all over again immediately. In one sense, the story is a basic romantic drama involving a divorced single mom and a couple that's been married for 10 years. But nothing in Behind Her Eyes is that basic, not even the geometry of its romantic triangle. And what begins almost as a romantic comedy finds itself flirting with different genres as it progresses. A bit revenge thriller here, and something else entirely a little later. Think of movies that stunned you by pulling the rug out from under you. Movies with key central shocks like The Sixth Sense, and The Usual Suspects, and The Crying Game, and Seven. Behind Her Eyes is right up there, and also connects, at one point literally, with Alice in Wonderland. And yet it starts so casually. Simona Brown plays Louise, a single mom out for a rare night at the pub. She literally bumps into a handsome stranger, David, played by Tom Bateman, and the two of them drink, joke, and end the night with a kiss before he quickly and apologetically breaks it off and leaves. A few days later, David reports for his new job as a psychiatrist, and when he enters his office, there stands Louise. He has no idea why, but she does. And she also knows, by now, that he's married.
Oh, God. It's you.
Yes, it's me. What happened? It was nothing. And we were both drunk. And trust me, I have no intention of telling anyone about it. So I think if we both do our best to act like it never happened, then there's no reason we can't just get along. And no one will ever know. Okay?
What are you doing here?
Oh, right. Yeah, your secretary. 3 days a week.
You are.
What are the odds? Oh, I actually saw you yesterday when you came in, then I hid.
You hid?
In the toilet?
I'd probably have done the same, to be fair.
I'm not sure me and you hiding in the ladies would have served the right purpose.
Hey, you're funny. Remember that.
The two of them remain intrigued by each other. And early on, there's another complication. In another seemingly accidental meeting, Louise meets David's wife, Adele. She's played by Bono's daughter, Eve Hewson. And like the other two leads, she's wonderful here. Totally unmannered, casual, and, as it turns out, inscrutable. They stop at a cafe, and Adele instantly wants to get some inside info from her husband's new secretary.
You must see a side to David I never do. Come on, Dish. What kind of boss is he?
It's only been a week, so it's not like I know him, really. But he's nice, professional, and the patients seem to like him.
Glad to hear it.
So, what do you do?
I've never really had a job, except for like 5 minutes in a florist. We have money, so. I thought maybe we'd have kids, but that hasn't happened. Not yet, anyway.
Do you have any friends in London?
Not really. I met all the partners and their significant others who are nice enough, but they're all a lot older than me and kind of stuck up, if I'm honest. Oh God, you probably know them all.
They're all a bit stuck up.
But now I've met you.
Behind Her Eyes explores these new relationships and also some old ones using a slowly revealing series of flashbacks. It ends up requiring an awful lot of these actors, and they deliver flawlessly. So does Steve Lightfoot, who created this adaptation for TV. He was a writer for NBC's Hannibal, which had lots of visual flair, and created the Netflix series The Punisher, one of the less impressive Marvel TV shows. But nothing in his past resume hints at the bold vision he and Eric Richter Strand, who directed all 6 episodes, pull off here. Consistently and brilliantly. The music choices, the color schemes, even the camera angles. Everything has a purpose, even if that purpose isn't revealed fully until the jaw-dropping conclusion. The actors keep you hooked from the very start. Tom Bateman is charming, yet potentially menacing, as David. Simona Brown is not only instantly vulnerable as Louise, but instantly lovable. And as Adele, Eve Hewson covers a 10-year time span so convincingly, it's as though she's playing two different people. Watch Behind Her Eyes. Then watch it again. Then find someone else who has, so you can really talk about it.
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and a professor of TV studies at Rowan University. Coming up, some of the most viewed, most remarkable, and revealing video of the January 6th Capitol riot was shot inside the Senate chamber by my guest, Luke Mogelson. Some of his video was used as evidence by House managers prosecuting Donald Trump in his second Senate impeachment trial. Mogelson was reporting for The New Yorker on the Trump rally that preceded the storming of the Capitol, walked with the mob to the Capitol, and after rioters breached the building, he entered with them. In the Senate chamber, he recorded video of Trump supporters opening the desks of senators, going through their papers, taking photos of the documents, stealing some of them. He recorded Jacob Chansley, the so-called QAnon shaman, saying a prayer at the dais in the chamber, bare-chested, face-painted, wearing his signature horned fur headdress. Mogelson's article, Among the Insurrectionists, was published in the January 25th issue of The New Yorker and is on the New Yorker website along with his video. While we were recording the interview February 24th, it was announced that Mogelson won a George Polk Award for his reporting in 2020 in three New Yorker articles that put his extensive experiences as a foreign war correspondent to use with firsthand accounts of domestic upheaval in the U.S. Luke Mogelson, welcome to Fresh Air. You were taking a lot of risks by going in the Senate chamber. If the MAGA people found out that you were a journalist, if the rioters found out you were a journalist, who knows what would have happened because they're so anti-journalism and anti-journalists. If the police arrested you, you'd have to say you were a journalist, but on the other hand, you didn't want to reveal that you were a journalist. So you were in a kind of losing situation in that respect. If anybody noticed you and tried to address you or stop you, what did you do to try to protect yourself from being discovered?
Nothing too elaborate or sneaky. I mean, I was just wearing my normal clothes and I was just filming with an iPhone. It was easier for me than for the photographers, obviously, because there were other people filming with their iPhones who were just Trump supporters and participants in the riot, but who were documenting everything either for themselves or as a kind of independent right-wing live streamers. So there are enough of those kind of folks around at most protests these days that an iPhone in and of itself doesn't really attract too much attention.
I would guess that some people participate so that they'll have videos to show friends and say, I was there.
Absolutely. And I think that's been a real boon for the FBI.
Right.
During its investigation. Yeah.
In describing the police at the Capitol, once you got inside, you say interactions between Trump supporters and law enforcement vacillated from homicidal belligerence to borderline camaraderie. Give us an example of both.
Once we were inside, the dynamic between the officers and the rioters switched completely. Whereas outside, they had been, you know, really going at the Trump supporters with nightsticks and pepper spray and rubber bullets, doing everything they could, honestly, to prevent them from breaching. Once they had breached, it was clear that a decision had been made not to engage them physically. So I went in through a broken window that, by the way, had been shattered by a Proud Boy, we now know, with a riot shield that he had taken off of a Capitol Police officer. Probably for me, the most striking example of the somewhat surreal camaraderie between the Capitol Police and the rioters was in the Senate chamber. After I had been in there for 20 or 30 minutes, it was flooded by a phalanx of police. I think it was a mix of Metropolitan Police and Capitol Police that far outnumbered the rioters who were still in the Senate chamber at that point. And I had been watching several of the rioters systematically go through senators' desks and collect documents. And when the police came into the chamber, everyone was rather politely asked to leave, to exit it. They could have easily arrested and searched everyone in there, but they didn't. There were two police officers standing on either side of the main entrance that opens on the center aisle of the chamber. And as we were walking past them, one of them was thanking each rioter for having been peaceful. Thank you for being peaceful. Thank you for being peaceful. We appreciate it. And what made his posture even more bizarre was that his shirt was ripped, his tie was crooked, his eyes were red from pepper spray. He had clearly just been in a violent altercation with another group of rioters. And as I exited the Senate chamber, I was walking behind a Trump supporter who had a blue folder in his hand full of documents that he had taken from the desks of the senators. We came out into a hallway, which was also full of police. And there were only, again, at this point, maybe a dozen Trump supporters being escorted out of the chamber. They were vastly outnumbered by the police at that time. But no one was arrested. No one was searched. They were led by a Capitol Police officer down a set of stairs to a side exit. The officer opened the door and everybody just walked out into the world, including the gentleman in front of me with the folder full of documents from Senator's desk.
One of them, I mean, you've pointed to one of the real mysteries of January 6th, which is why weren't the protesters, as they left the building that they had stormed, why weren't they arrested? Why weren't their weapons confiscated? Why were they allowed to leave with documents from the senators' desks? I'm wondering if you have any clarity about that. I mean, it's possible that the police just wanted these people out as soon as possible. And the way to do that, and the way to do that most efficiently, would be to have them peacefully file out and not feel more threatened and start using their weapons. Because, you know, you had people hiding in that building. You had our elected officials and their staff and family hiding in that building. So it could be the goal was just like, get them out, get the protesters out.
Exactly. And I think that's what it was. It was clearly a deliberate attempt to de-escalate. And that was the priority. They weren't trying to collect evidence or investigate or set up future prosecutions. They were attempting to avoid what could have been a totally catastrophic situation and much more deadly situation. And I think that they succeeded in doing that.
One of the most dramatic parts of your video is in the background, like off camera, you hear somebody chanting and kind of growling in an almost animalistic way. And it's a very disturbing sound. And it turns out it's the voice of Jacob Chansley, a.k.a. the QAnon shaman. And this is the guy who comes in bare-chested, face-painted, with his fur-horned headdress. Had you encountered him before? Did you know about him?
The first time I encountered Jacob Chansley was that morning at the Washington Monument, when I was walking around kind of just filming the crowd, taking notes, trying to get a sense of the energy and who was there. I saw this guy with a headdress and horns and a megaphone yelling about actually an executive order that Trump had signed in 2019 to prevent Russian meddling in elections. And Chansley was saying through his megaphone that, you know, Trump saw this coming and that's why he had signed this executive order and he's going to declare martial law and you know, the storm is here, and trying to kind of rev up the crowd. So I followed him, filming him for around 10 minutes. And so I recognized him when he came into the Senate chamber later that day.
Describe what he did after he came in that you captured on video.
So first he was up in the gallery and was just kind of chanting and pounding his spear, which had an American flag tied onto it. And people down on the Senate floor were getting kind of annoyed with him, like asking him to knock it off.
They really said that? They really asked him to do that?
Yeah. There was a young guy. He's since been arrested, so we know a little bit about him. He's from Leeds, Alabama. His name was Joshua Black, and he was in there kind of keeping order. There was a tension throughout the insurrection inside the Capitol between people who just wanted to ransack, steal stuff, and people who felt like they needed to be respectful of the space and kept saying stuff like, this is our house, respect our house, this is why we're here, this is what we're fighting for. So they had this kind of logic in their heads. A lot of them, I think, were military veterans that once they were inside, they should be mindful and respectful of this kind of sacred space. So inside the Senate chamber, there were people from both camps and they were arguing. And Joshua Black was more authoritative and intimidating individual, I think, than the other folks who wanted to riot, because he had been shot in the face with a rubber bullet that was still embedded inside of his cheek, and it was kind of pulsing blood into his beard, and he had this like bloodstained gauze hanging around his neck. So he yelled at Jacob Chansley, you know, stop acting a fool, cut it out. He was also preventing people from, you know, sitting in Vice President Pence's chair and vandalizing basically the Senate chamber. And that's why after about 10 minutes, most of the people inside the chamber left, because it wasn't really fun in there with Joshua Black telling them what they could and couldn't do.
It's interesting what you're saying about the reaction to, you know, the so-called QAnon shaman. I've always wondered, you know, ever since the insurrection, whether other people consider him a shaman or whether he just has decided that he is a shaman, but he has nobody who believes it. Because, you know, let's face it, he looks ludicrous. And it sounds like he doesn't really have followers.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's kind of been my experience in general with most people who call themselves shamans. But he definitely commanded respect among people at the Washington Monument when I was following him around. People recognized him. People yelled out to him. He was kind of leading folks in this QAnon chant of where we go one, we go all. So he was a kind of iconic, known personality from right-wing and pro-Trump events in Arizona and online. But I think also the way that different people responded to him in the Senate chamber kind of illustrates how, I won't say diverse, but not monolithic the insurrectionists were. They weren't all fanatical QAnon extremists or, you know, fringe conspiracists. There was a wide, wide range of Americans who took part in this. And for plenty of them, I think a guy, you know, with no shirt and horns and a spear was not representative of their cause and purpose.
Do you know anything about Chansley, the QAnon shaman? Do you know anything about his mental health situation?
I would never second guess anybody's mental health or claim to mental illness. My experience of him inside the chamber did not seem to suggest that he was mentally ill. After he left the gallery, he came downstairs and entered the Senate floor through the main door and immediately installed himself on the dais behind the vice president's desk and in his chair and started posing for pictures and kind of hamming it up and seemed to be, you know, not only in control of his faculties, but also determined to exploit the situation to his benefit as much as possible, including getting people to, you know, take pictures of him and film him. And there were a lot of other people throughout the day, and especially inside the Senate chamber, who didn't mind being filmed because they clearly thought that they were in the right and that there was nothing wrong with what they were doing. They believed that they were acting at the behest of the president, and they also believed that they were stopping an illegal transfer of power. And essentially what, in their view, was a coup. Not only a coup, but a coup by an evil Satan-worshipping pedophile. So if that's your worldview, there's no reason to conceal or be ashamed of your role being documented.
So before you left the Senate chamber, you were able to go to the dais where, you know, the shaman had been, and you were able to video the note that he left on the page with the Senate roll call. Tell us what he had written.
He had written, "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming!" Exclamation mark.
How were you able to get to the dais? At what point did you get there to video that note?
Just as soon as I saw him writing on a piece of paper on the desk, I just walked up to the desk to capture what he had written. And, you know, he actually, when he saw me coming to film, he actually flipped the paper around so that I could get a clear shot of it. And again, that wasn't only him. There were other folks in the Senate chamber who were rifling through Senator's desk, and I would go up to try to capture what exactly they were looking for and what they were removing from the desk. And they'd hold the documents up for me to show me, and sometimes even smile, like for the camera. So I don't think it was that's just illustrative of kind of Chansley's potential insanity. I think it's also all these people who, again, had no inkling that what they were doing was wrong, or suspicion that it could result in consequences for them.
I'm so grateful to you for coming on our show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. I really appreciate it.
Luke Mogelson reports for The New Yorker. His article, "Among the Insurrectionists," and his video of the storming of the Capitol are on The New Yorker website.